So welcome everybody. Thank you so much for coming today to the Legal Technology Bootcamp. We're really excited to have you. I am Tammy Oltz. I'm the director of the Law Library. And we've got a great lineup of speakers here today to talk about some of the advances going on in legal technology. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Professor McGinnis, who many of you probably already know. He's been with UND School of Law since 2010 and is about to become our brand new dean.
Thank you, Professor Oltz. Howard, thank you. Well, it's a pleasure to be here with you this afternoon. As Tammy said, I'm going to be starting as dean on July 1st, so eager to get going, and a lot of good things happening already, but we're working hard on the transition. I'm also enjoying the opportunity to teach this semester, and also be talk to you about professional responsibility connected with legal technology. So before we get into the rules themselves, though, and talk about the nitty-gritty of rules 1.1, 1.6, et cetera, let's talk a little bit about technology and where it's come. Because I'm 50 years old, I turned 50 last year. So I'm in the same boat as a number of you in terms of where I've seen technology grow over these recent decades. When I was a law student, back at William & Mary many years ago, I had a Mac Classic on my desk at home, no laptops, none of that going on. I'd type it up my outlines on the computer, no laptops in the classroom to actually write. You had to write in the blue books. You had no choice. You didn't have the option. So it's come a long way. I do remember those were the early days of Westlaw, so it was this kind of strange computerized research that you could do. And we did that at the law school, and then when I started practice, it was also very big when I started work in Delaware. I was at a firm, Potter Anderson Croon, there when I first got on my clerkship. They actually sold us, we have computers for each of our associates. So that was a big draw. Like, okay, you have a computer for each of our associates on your desk. It's like, that's great. And then was a summer associate, actually. I had to scout around because we didn't have our own designated computer. So we had to kind of find out, okay, which secretary's out today? Can we use their computer to do our research and do our work? So very different world. Sending faxes, which still some faxes that go on out around, but now everything's scanning and emailing, so it changes. So lawyers have had to find ways to keep up with those changes, and some, you know, to learn the new technology to the extent it applies to their practice, to be able to identify problems that can arise related to technology. They're both opportunities and some problems that can happen. And the rules of professional conduct, for the longest time, didn't really adapt to the changes in the technological platforms that people were working in. But about, I think it was about 10 years ago now, the ABA set up a commission called the Ethics 2020 Commission. And it was charged with trying to go through the rules, not necessarily create new obligations, but kind of recognize the challenges that legal technology posed for applying the existing doctrines, the existing duties that lawyers have under the rules. So they went through it, and I have a little display, this is from the ABA back in 2011, when they reported back on what they had found and talked about the commission's process, you know, taking in input from all around the profession, talking about the increasing use of electronic media in particular to give legal advice and information. You know, the first one was the scary email. You know, like, what is that? Is that really confidential? Does that violate confidentiality? No, it's fine. You can use email as long as you're properly securing your information. You're fine. But it's gone way past that. So it was text, podcasts, blogs, tweets, websites, all the kinds of communication tools that lawyers will use in connection with their practices in one way or another. Talking about the use of client confidence, it's not just the filing cabinet, but it's on anymore. It's on laptops, smartphones, tablets, in the cloud, et cetera. The way that lawyers advertise is connected with this too. So all these things were important, and they said, let's try to update the rules and at least recognize these changes and try to give lawyers some help, basically, in understanding how to manage these challenges. So rather than go through the text of the report, what I want to do is talk about the changes they implemented, some of the ways in which our North Dakota lawyers' rules of professional conduct have taken those changes from the ABA, because those are just recommendations, of course, which ones were adopted. The ABA's the report came out in 2011. They adopted the rules changes at the ABA level for the model rules in 2012, and then states got working on considering them. So I was on the Joint Committee on Attorney Standards, which I currently chair, but I was a member at the time when these Ethics 2020 changes came through. We looked through them as a committee, made recommendations to the court about which ones made sense for North Dakota practice, and then we then the court adopted those changes. Okay. So what we're going to do is start with the first rule in the Rules of Professional Conduct after the preamble and the scope rule, scope provisions, and then the terminology. The very first rule, and I'm going to make sure this display is okay, a little bit lighter for you, a little easier to see. Is that good? Okay. Competence. So the competence rule, of course, is one of the short rules of professional conduct. Lawyer shall provide competent representation to a client. The competent representation requires the legal knowledge, skill, thoroughness, and preparation reasonably necessary for the representation. Very broad rule, hasn't changed. That tech part of the rule hasn't changed since the model rules were adopted back in the 1980s. It's the application of that that's gotten challenging in various new contexts. And the key rule, key provision of the comment to the rule, which explains what the rule itself means, is number 5. And this is the new edition after the Ethics 2020. And it says, and this kind of frames the things you'll be thinking about this afternoon, hearing the different speakers, to maintain the requisite knowledge and skill to be for that competence requirement, a lawyer must keep abreast of changes in the law and his practice. So it doesn't say should, it says must. The rules are very careful about when they choose that. This is saying that's part of competence, is to keep abreast of changes in the law and his practice, including the benefits and risks, pros and cons, the things that you need to be thoughtful that you can, your clients can benefit from, but also the risks that are associated with it, with technology. Engage in continuing study and education and comply with all continuing legal education requirements. So part of what you're doing is a twofer. Now you're keeping abreast of technology and doing the continuing legal education part. So thinking about the ways in which clients and their interests can be impacted by technology is important. There's another part of the rule that was, or the comment that was added in the same process at the same time as Ethics 2020. This provision 7 that deals with retaining or contracting with other lawyers. So when you associate with other lawyers and you're going to be sharing information with them, you want to have some understanding or confidence that they too are going to comply with their own rule obligations. Okay, so you have to be thoughtful about this. Normally it comes, you know, this rule gets adopted or this principle gets applied when, in terms of substantive competence. So you don't want to, working with another law firm when you think that they can't manage the case or they're not going to be able to provide competent assistance to the client and be ethical in doing so. But it does, the comment itself reflects it by the see also list, that confidentiality is part of that. So you have to have some, you want to have some assurance or some confidence that they're going to be able to maintain those obligations as well. So the environment in which they're practicing is going to be acceptable. All right. Now, let's move to Rule 1.6. Now, I'm not going to, I know we have a great speaker, Tracy Cobb, who's coming after me. She wrote an article for the North Dakota Law Review a few years ago on this topic of confidentiality and Rule 1.6. So I won't steal her thunder and talk about all the specific applications that I know she'll be speaking about. But let's talk a little bit about confidentiality and how the rule itself has been amended. You know, the general obligation, of course, is as it always has been, at least since the model rules have been in place for several decades, that lawyers can't reveal information relating to the representation of the client unless the client consents or there's an implied authorization or you have an explicit exception that's recognized under the rules. And this, of course, continues after the lawyer-client relationship has terminated. So it's both while the client is with you and then afterwards. The provision that was added is Part D. It's under the North Dakota rules. It falls under Section D of the rule, and I've highlighted it there for you, that lawyers also have to take reasonable efforts to prevent the inadvertent or authorized disclosure of or unauthorized access to information relating to the client. So it says, you know, the first part of the rule says don't reveal, which is an active step. I'm going to disclose. I make a decision. I will choose to reveal this. And you have to be mindful of that, of course. But this makes clear that there's also an effort to prevent the inadvertent disclosure, where there isn't a decision to disclose, but it happens. The information's out, and as far as the client's concerned, that's a problem, just as if you had intentionally resolved, made the revelation of the information. And unauthorized access is a big one, with hacking, with efforts with regard to cybersecurity. The fact that there's been, you know, if you look in the news about the legal profession over the years, there have been hacks on major law firms where they will get access to client information. It's also the other part of it, which I don't know if we'll get into much because it's technology, but it's a piece of it too. Lawyer trust accounts. There have been hacks on where they've actually duped partners at law firms into providing information that gives them access to client trust accounts. And before you know it, the accounts are becoming depleted or being intentionally accessed by unauthorized persons. But all this comes into technological barriers, because the way they get in these situations, it isn't just like keeping a locked filing cabinet. It's thinking about how they can get into your office without ever setting foot in it, using the technological tools that are available to them. So I'll leave the particulars on that, developing that to Tracy in her discussion. But that's something that is now explicitly recognized in the rule, and that is important to keep in mind about how to actually prevent these harms as part of your duties to the client, instead of simply making sure that things don't get released, or make sure they're not released on purpose. The comment to the rule, which is comment 18, which digs into this particular topic about acting competently to preserve confidentiality. It talks about the third-party access being unauthorized to safeguard information. They use the word competent, so it's part of the competence duty is to protect this information. And it says, the lawyer or other persons who are participating in the representation of the client or who are subject to your supervision. So this gets into something I'll talk about a little more with the rules 5.1 and 5.3, the idea of employees. That idea of having, if you're responsible in your law firm for the management of the firm or supervising others within the firm, your duty extends to taking reasonable steps, not perfect, reasonable steps to prevent them from doing things that will compromise client information. It could be having instruction, policies, a combination of those. It takes different forms depending on the type of practice. But the idea is you have to have these policies or these provisions in place, and having the training that's in place to reasonably safeguard the information, or make sure that your employees or others who work in your office are acting consistently with these obligations as well. So they talk about, you know, in this particular part of the comment, what's going to be reasonable, because, you know, we talk to students all the time, reasonable, do what's reasonable. What's reasonable? The ever popular one, all the way from the first year, that's one. Well, they give us some guidance on that, fortunately, and they talk about factors to consider. So these you can be thinking about, do I have to do, how expensive does it need to be? How much effort do I need to go to? Well, they look at the sensitivity of the information, the likelihood of a disclosure if additional safeguards are not employed, the cost of employing additional safeguards, the difficulty of implementing them, the extent to which the safeguards adversely affect the lawyer's ability to represent clients. For example, it could make a device or important piece of software excessively difficult to use. That's part of what they're looking at. So for most lawyers and most practices, it's not going to be elaborate safeguards, but there's going to be simple things that you can put in place to do that. And as I said, I think Tracy will probably be discussing some of those ideas in more specificity. Okay. If your client, however, asks you to put special security measures in place, right? They say, this I want you to do something extra special with to ensure that it doesn't get released. You need to follow that instruction. If they're willing to pay for that. But also, they may consent to forego security measures. They can waive that, although I'd be really cautious about that. I think it's good to have a standard protective policy in place for clients. All right. I think we'll just leave that there because it does deliver a little more information there, but for the sake of time, I think I'll just move forward onto the next piece. Any questions so far? It's kind of the overview, the big picture. Okay. All right. Let's talk about 5.1 and 5.3. So these are, I alluded to these a moment ago, responsibilities of partners, managers, and supervisors. So if you're a partner or a lawyer who individually or together with other lawyers has comparable managerial authority, then you need to take reasonable efforts to ensure that the firm has, in effect, measures giving reasonable assurance that all lawyers in the firm are going to comply with the rules. That includes confidentiality and others. And then, of course, if you have direct supervisory authority over another lawyer, you make reasonable efforts to ensure that that lawyer conforms with the rules. Even if you're not the managing person at the office, if you're supervising an associate, for instance, then you need to take these reasonable steps to do so. So that frames the obligation as a whole with regarding other lawyers. But the one that can be sometimes the most challenging in the idea of technology, perhaps, is non-lawyer assistants, because there's more of them often. They may not be there as long, depending on how long they're working at the firm. They may just be there for a summer. They may be there for some sort of other arrangement. But everyone needs to be, who comes under your cover in that way, in terms of working in the practice, needs to be reasonably supervised and given being subject to some steps to protect against violations of the professional obligations that you have to your clients. So they can't be disciplined, but the lawyer can, is what it boils down to. And again, it's a reasonableness standard that is applied to this circumstance. One thing that often lawyers overlook with regard to 5.3, though, is that it applies not just to non-lawyer assistants who are under your roof. I was just mentioning that group. That's the most conspicuous one, but there's also lawyers outside the firm, okay? So you are working with, this comes in a little bit when we talk about cloud work, when you have some sort of way of storing information in a cloud service, but you are using non-lawyers outside the firm to assist you in rendering legal services to the client. They are people for whom you have some responsibility. Now, it's harder to in some ways to accomplish this kind of supervision because they're not under your roof, but you still need to take what's a reasonable step for that relationship to protect the client's interests. Examples, I mean, there's any number of them, but investigative or paraprofessional services that you work as an independent contract relationship. You hire a document management company. This may or not apply depending on nature of practice, but in firms that have these kinds of practices with complex litigation, you may get a company that actually is going to be taking possession of these client files and information, sending client documents to a third party for printing or scanning, and using an internet-based service to store client information. That's probably the newest one, the one that's caused a little more attention in recent years, using the cloud to do that. And again, the standard is written the same. That has to be reasonable efforts for that kind of relationship. Understanding you may not have the degree of control that you would if it's happening under your roof. And the extent of the obligation depends on the circumstances. You think about the education, experience, or reputation of the non-lawyer, the nature of the services involved, any arrangements concerning the terms on protection of client information, and the legal and ethical environments of the jurisdictions that are performed, particularly with regard to confidentiality. So on this piece, with providers like this, it may be something as simple as a basic written agreement to maintain confidence so that they know you have confidentiality obligations. There's often would be some standard forms for that kind of an understanding before you actually give them that access. Okay. And last rule I want to mention, and then we'll open it up for discussion before we close, is a rule that's been in place for a while. It's rule 4.5 under the North Dakota rules about inadvertent transmission. And North Dakota has a variation from the model rule on this. North Dakota is, it tends to follow the model rules, but it also is quite willing to make changes and differ in areas where, even if it has a counterpart rule, it says we want to have a slightly different requirement, or even sometimes a more significantly different one. In this case, lawyers who receive a document or electronically stored information relating to the representation of the client and know or reasonably should know that the document or electronically stored information was inadvertently sent, it says shall promptly notify the sender. Okay, so the duty here is very specific to let the person know that you've received it. For instance, if you've ever gotten a misdirected email, how many have gotten a misdirected email before? In some context, or yep. So now, it's innocuous if it's just a non-lawyer client representation situation. You just say, oh, that wasn't intended for me. If you get, say, something where they thought they were communicating with their client and instead they sent an email to you, then you can imagine if you were on the other end of this, what would you want someone to do? Notify you, not keep a copy of it. The rule itself doesn't say that you must do that. It says you have to notify the sender. So it doesn't require you to destroy copies. It doesn't require not to use the information. It's the mandate is that you notify them so that if they wish to take some action with the court, for instance, to try to deal with a possible waiver of attorney-client privilege, that they're able to do that. But here's a nice piece about the North Dakota rule in terms of the kind of sending a signal about expectations, even if it's not a requirement. It specifically says that a lawyer who receives a document, including the misdirected email or some other form of communication, under the circumstances creating a duty under this rule, does not violate Rule 1.2 or 1.4, dealing with the means of representation under 1.2, and 1.4 deals with communication, by not communicating or consulting with the client regarding the receipt or return of the document. Why might that be? Why does it say that? Because if you say you've got a document that's really damaging for the other side, inadvertently, okay? It's in your hands. And you say, well, as a lawyer, I know what the right thing to do here is. If she were on the other foot, what would I want the other lawyer to do for me if I had made an inadvertent transmission that was clearly inadvertent? You probably want them to not use it against you, right? Well, what happens if, normally if you get something significant like that, and that happens in a case, what are you supposed to do? Tell the client, right? So that you can at least, in Rule 1.2 talks about this, consult with them about the means to use to carry out the representation. You may still get the decision to make whether we're returning the document. That may be considered a means area that's outside, that's within your purview as the lawyer, as opposed to the client making the call on that, like they would with regard to settling a case or other things of that nature. But normally you'd have to communicate. You'd be expected to talk with the client about it. At least many lawyers would feel that that's what they're supposed to do. The North Dakota rule gives the lawyer the freedom to say, you know what? That was a mistake. It was an inadvertent disclosure. As a professional, I'm keeping that to myself. I can choose not to tell the client about it. Because, of course, what if it's something damaging? The client says, you're definitely using this or I'm firing you, right? It's sending a signal, I think, and I wasn't there for this particular piece of the rule design. I was there for the comment revision, but I think the idea behind it is create some breathing room for the lawyer to make an independent decision about what they think is right to do under the circumstances without having the client kind of push them in a certain direction because it's an inadvertent transmission. Now, just to conclude on the piece on 4.5, this is also dealing with the idea of metadata. Which is many ethics opinions on the question of metadata. It is embedded information that's found in a document that doesn't appear on the surface. So you may have a Word document and you say, oh, I can call it up and here's the text of the document, here's what it says. Well, kind of underneath the surface, at the strata below there, there's all this real interesting stuff that can be still left in there, prior versions or edits that were made. That maybe reflect. I mean, many times it's innocuous. No one really cares. But sometimes it can have legal significance in terms of what the people were, who edited the document, what they said to each other, in terms of comments. And So this is something that you want to be aware of. If you have a document that you're going to send out to another party, be aware of whether or not there may be sensitive information that's still there that needs to be taken out through. Usually there's fairly simple means to do this using the software itself or others. But if be conscious of that, because if you send it out, then that metadata may be something that the other side will obtain. Okay. Questions before, just to wrap up before Tracy starts up for us.
Professor McGinnis, can you talk a little bit about the jurisdictional issues with storing data on the cloud? For example, if you're backing your data, is it the jurisdiction of where the server is located that's going to govern what sort of investigation you should make with respect to the obligations of that non-lawyer third party?
That's a really good question. So because the servers are typically stored outside of your own state boundaries, and if generally speaking, I'm trying to think of the latest I've seen on this, I think for as far as the choice of professional obligation, you're going to be bound by the rules of your home state for these kind of situations in terms of that. But you're also going to be aware in terms of what law is applicable to that provider with regard to their own actions under the storage agreement. So I don't know if there's any necessarily one size fits all in that, but you may include, one thing you could do is reach an agreement with that provider that says that I'm going to comply, it needs to comply with the laws of and the rules of my state to be on the safe side. Any other questions? Anne? I'm not sure there's a lot of disciplinary cases. There are some malpractice cases that happen for failure to maintain. So there's a little bit of that going on. It hasn't so much been in the realm of professional discipline as much, though, as far as I've seen. So and usually if it's going to be a malpractice case, it'd have to be something where there was a significant fallout to the client because you have to prove the harm. So it'd have to be a pretty significant invasion of the client information to usually get that. Anyone else? All right, well, thanks for your attention. And we'll turn it over to Tracy for the next step.